Talking. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Context Podcast. I'm Kate Langsdorf, your host, and I'm here with Sally Olive, who is a Philadelphia and Seattle-based director and dramaturg. Today, we're mostly talking about her work as the Associate Artistic Director of the Bearded Ladies Cabaret out of Philadelphia, because she does dramaturgy for cabaret, which is not the standard way I hear of people using dramaturgy. So I'm super excited about that. Sally, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yay. So right before we started recording, you were telling me about your, you live in Seattle, but you are mostly a Philadelphia theater person. So how long ago did you move to Seattle?
Yeah. So I moved to Seattle about 3 years ago in November.
Oh, cool.
But I like to say that I've only been in Seattle for about a year and a half because I spent so much time flying back and forth. And so this year, for example, I think I was in Philly for about 2.5 months total. So I was in Philadelphia for about, I think, 10 years as a dramaturg. I did new play dramaturgy. I did traditional literary management. I did devised dramaturgy, and that's also where I started working with my cabaret company, the Bearded Ladies Cabaret. And then I moved to Seattle, and I'm starting to meet people here and starting to do some freelance dramaturgy here, which has been exciting to get to know two very different cities at very different stages of, I guess, their theatrical development. Has been truly fascinating. And if I could like find ways to bridge people between those two spaces, I would love to do more of that. But
for sure. Yeah. And looking at your bio. So one of the like most traditional uses of dramaturgy I could think of is also on your bio. You were the literary manager at Arden Theater Company. And are you finding that doing cabaret dramaturgy feels like the full opposite of that, or do they have more in common than I would think when looking at them? Oh, you're frozen. Oh no, Zen. And pause.
A double pleasure's waiting for you. A double pleasure from Double Mint Gum. A double great feeling.
Okay. We're recording again. Either weather or internet or something made us drop each other for a second. So there was probably a brief musical interlude for those of you listening along at home. And we're back! Yay! Magic of the internet. So you were telling me about your transition to Seattle. So you've been there basically for 3 years, but in real life, you're still a Philadelphia theater artist.
Yeah, I'd say I'm still learning more about the Seattle community and what's here and what people are doing. I'd say I'm still very new to what's going on in Seattle, but I feel like an old hand at what's going on in Philadelphia.
Excellent. Oh, and I remember I was asking you about your work at Arden.
Oh, right, at the Arden. That's right.
The literary manager, which is kind of the gold standard in a lot of ways for just a traditional dramaturgy trajectory is like, it would seem to me, to like get a job as the full-time literary manager at a theater company like the Arden and then just be doing the work. Do you miss that steadiness?
Well, I should say that while I was at the Arden, I was never full-time.
Oh.
I was always a part-time literary manager. And so what was really exciting about that time for me is I was, yeah, doing the big regional theater literary management resourced thing. I was also working for a small, mid-size theater called Azuka Theater Company, which is a member of the National New Play Network.
And I'm an ambassador for the National New Play Network and used to do their communications. So I know Azuka's work and I know they're great.
Yeah, so I was ping-ponging between like a Lort C&D theater Theater that I think at the time the space that we were using was mostly, I think it was about 120 seat, mm-hmm. and really focusing on new plays and really focusing on local writers. And I was also starting this work in cabaret with devised theater companies, with specifically with the Bearded Ladies. And so I think running between those three very different institutional two like fringy mm-hmm. Spaces was crazy, but also helped me see the connections between them and mostly the differences and figure out for myself where I felt the most useful. And where I felt the most useful was in the fringe forms, I found.
Cool. So what about the fringe forms made you feel useful?
Yeah, I sometimes talk about that kind of work as being like dramaturgy in 3D. Mm-hmm. I think particularly when you're in a large regional theater, at least it was my experience, that a lot of the work that I was doing was office work.
Yeah.
And advocacy and desks and meetings. And I think all of those things are really important and valuable in promoting new plays across the country and in doing, you know, important revivals. The Arden is a huge producer of Sondheim. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think one of the last projects I worked on there was Passion, which is not a play that, not a musical that's brought out very often.
Wow.
So it was fun to dive into that. But there's something about being in a room as something is actively being created collaboratively that I feel like what I'm particularly skilled at as a dramaturg is structural things.
Oh, that's a useful skill set.
Yeah. So, and I find that the work that I'm able to do in the moment for me is more rewarding, I think, than the kind of long, slow haul that I found in literary departments. It just suits the way that my brain works.
Yeah.
Best.
Yeah. So there are such differing job realities that can go with being a dramaturg. And some I've been getting in the habit of asking everyone, hey, can you tell us what dramaturgy is?
Yeah, this is going to be a real fun hour because we're probably going to have to go through this with cabaret too.
Okay.
Which is, I find the definition of dramaturgy, I think like most of us do, really difficult because it is so dependent on not only the project you're working on, the kind of work that you do, but also who you are as a dramaturg.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's actually so many different ways of defining a dramaturg just based on the kind of work that you respond to. But the definition I'm working with right now, because I know we love metaphors, is... We were doing a grant application for this cabaret history project that we'll probably talk a little bit about. And one of the things that we were asked to provide was a list of thought partners. And oh. I really loved that term, thought partner. And one of my collaborators was like, well, that's what you do. You're a thought partner.
You're my thought partner.
And I was like, that's brilliant. It's so concise. It covers so much, and it does feel like a lot of what I do is bouncing ideas back and forth, acting as a sounding board sometimes, but also sometimes pointing things out that people hadn't thought of. I get this image of tennis in my head of like bouncing the thought ball back and forth.
I like that.
I do too. So that's the one that I've been using for the past couple of years. With people that are in theater and kind of already know what a dramaturg is, which I assume that most of the people listening to this podcast are. For people who are not likely to know what a dramaturg is, sometimes I just say I'm a set designer. I'm like,
really?
Leave it there.
That's
yeah, like in like Uber, like when the Uber driver's like, what do you do? Like, I just want to go to sleep in the back seat, so I'm just going to tell you I'm a set designer.
Yeah.
There's no follow-up questions there.
Do you actually design very many sets, or is that just sort of the way to shut down the conversation?
For me, it's a way to shut down the conversation. I have never designed a set. I am in awe of people who are set designers.
You know, we just had, what was it, yesterday, there was a Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas online, like a Zoom meeting that we started doing these professional development programs that are like an hour long online happy hour once a month, and the topic yesterday was living the hyphenate life. And so there were five panelists who were like five different styles of dramaturg, and one is mostly a sound designer, and that's like the lens through which she basically does most of her dramaturgy, even though it comes in various forms. So I have been really, like, it wouldn't have been the most outlandish thing in my mind based on where I'm thinking right now. Like, oh yeah, you're a dramaturg who uses, you know, the visual landscape as the entry point.
Oh, totally. I mean, some of the best, like, dramaturgs that I've gotten, because dramaturgs don't usually get to collaborate with each other.
Right.
So when I feel like I've gotten really to collaborate with people who feel like dramaturgs to me, it's usually designers. It's usually people who are thinking about the story in this macro and micro way. Yeah, I think, like, one of my favorite collaborators is a video and sound designer out of Philadelphia named Jorg Cousineau, who I think is one of the best dramaturgs that I've ever worked with.
Oh, that's very cool.
But would never call himself that.
Yeah.
But his insights are always, like, are always spot on.
That's something that that was important to me about starting this podcast, is that I think there are so many people who have a dramaturgical practice, who are doing the work, who don't identify as dramaturgs and maybe don't even use the word or know that it's a word that exists. But, like, I think everybody who's doing that meaning making work for artists and audiences, I think should join our club, like, at least our metaphorical club, if not specifically LMDA and our happy hours. That reminds me of how do you build the physical world for cabaret? Because it seems like a form where you don't need much in terms of a set to be able to bring the audience into the world of the show. So what does that look like when you want to bring the audience into that world?
Yeah, so there's a few different ways. And my company does, we do traditional cabaret, and we also do, or what I would call traditional cabaret, which often has, you're just on the set that is there for you, and mm-hmm. you show up that day and you put something up. And so whatever that space is the space. We also do something that we call cabaret plays, which are sort of a hybrid form between traditional devised theater and cabaret. And I guess, the reason I'm distinguishing those two is because I think it depends on which one we're doing.
Cool.
For traditional cabaret, I think there's a few things that are generally true of the spaces that we perform in. One is that they're usually pretty intimate. The other is that the seating is typically, although not always, like what you would think of when you think of cabaret seating. So tiny tables, chairs.
Yeah.
Usually a pretty small performance space. Hopefully there's enough room for the band. There's not always.
Ooh, and is a live band an important part of the work that you're doing?
For the work that I generally do, yes. But certainly not for all cabaret artists.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of cabaret artists that work with playback, for example. So lip sync. Like, there's a strain of cabaret artists who are lip sync artists. There's also some that would maybe identify themselves more as comedians.
Okay.
So it's a pretty broad and hard to define.
Right. But that's okay.
Work situation. Yeah. But in terms of the space, we came up with a, we made up a word for the kinds of spaces that we generally perform in, which is, desegregated space.
Okay.
Which is a designated integrated space. And by integrated, we mean it's a space that is usually used for some purpose that is not performance specific.
Okay. So it's not that you would necessarily be like coming in like, oh, this theater is doing Romeo and Juliet right now, but tonight we're going to do a cabaret on the balcony. It's like, you could be coming in.
I mean, that might be one. I mean, that might be one version of like, this space is usually a traditional theater space that's performing Romeo and Juliet,
mm-hmm.
but we're going to designate it something different. It is often, though, that we perform, more in places that are restaurant bars. We got our start, my company got our start in the lobby of the Wilma Theater.
Oh, cool.
For 3 years. Yeah. So it, which we sort of turned into a cabaret space, but it was not itself naturally made to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's important about those spaces is that it's the audience's space that the performer is moving into. It's not I think traditional theaters, audience is coming into a space for performance.
Yeah.
And they're entering into the world of the performance. In cabaret, the performer is entering into the world of the audience.
That's a very cool distinction.
Yeah. And I think that's, I think that that distinction is sort of at the root. It took us a while to figure it out, and it actually really took us trying to do an immersive cabaret piece to really get that. And we were helped by, there's a wonderful book about the history of Harlem cabaret by a scholar named Shane Vogel, who I think teaches at Bloomington in Indiana.
Oh, okay.
Who talks a little bit about the difference between environmental theater and cabaret, and so make some of these points. And it's a great book that I will plug happily.
Say the name of it again, because I will link to it in the show notes.
Yes, the name of the book is The Scene of Harlem Cabaret.
The Scene.
And it's,
okay, cool.
Yeah, and it's mostly a look at the Harlem Renaissance, the cabaret scene of the Harlem Renaissance. But in order to do so, he takes a stab at defining cabaret, which is always as interesting as trying to define dramaturgy, I think. Anyway, so I do think that cabaret, for it to work, the audience needs to feel comfortable, and they need to feel like they're on the same plane as the performer. And that often translates literally. So even if you have a stage, the stage is not necessarily the most important part of the room. The most important part of the room is usually the bar. there's a lot of drinking.
I like it.
That goes on with cabaret. So I think, that's when we do traditional cabaret. And there are, you know, there are spaces that are cabaret spaces. Joe's Pub is a great example in New York. But even there you have, you know, you have a full restaurant service. Audiences are encouraged to get there early, to start drinking. Cabaret usually starts a little late. It's on what we call drag time. and some of that is intentional. Some of it's about letting the audience really feel like they have ownership over the space before the performance starts. And then when we do cabaret plays, we kind of build on that. So it's basically that same idea, but now with some set dressing that might give the audience clues about what the world of the cabaret play will be. But it's still, we're still really trying to build off of this idea of audience primacy.
So when you are working on a cabaret play, is it something that the audience has an idea of what they have bought tickets for? Is there even a ticket buying mechanism, or is it just, I know I'm going to see a cabaret thing with bearded ladies, let's go do that?
Yeah, so our marketing usually has to precede the actual creation of the show, which I think is actually pretty common with a lot of devised artists that I talk to. So the audience usually has some idea of maybe the tone and rough topics, and we try to name some songs that we think we might sing.
Cool.
But that's about it. So they are, I think they're primarily coming because they want to see a bearded lady's show, as opposed to they want to see this show about this specific topic. But we do try to give people an indication of what they're going to see, which I think is less cabaret and more devised, like more of a devised theater problem of like, how do you describe something that hasn't been made yet?
Right.
And we run into trouble sometimes where what we've said we're going to do is not what we've ended up doing. And
are people disappointed and throwing drinks?
People are usually happy to roll with it. Critics are not always as, they're like, this is what I was expecting and this is not what I'm receiving, which I can't really blame them for.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. I don't really think of theater criticism as getting really into the world of cabaret performance, but is that the difference between the cab a play and a cabaret, is that they will review it in the what used to be known as the calendar section? And
yes. Yeah, so like when we do one-off, like we have a monthly series that happens that's in collaboration with Fringe Arts in Philadelphia, called Get Pegged. Nobody's reviewing those. Like those are like one night sloppy. They go up very quickly. There's usually some guests. They're a ton of fun and casual. But when we're doing like a 2 to 3 week run in the Wilma, even if it's in the lobby, there are certain different kinds of expectations that get put out. And so, yeah, then we get treated like a traditional theater performance.
Okay. So when you are doing a run that's in the lobby of a theater, is that like a public space, or is it something where people will get ticketed and come in, or is it almost like street performance at that point?
Yeah, so we do a few different versions. We like to partner with affiliate organizations. We work best as like a barnacle, is what we say, that we like barnacle onto larger organizations. So when we were at the Wilma, when we were getting started, yeah, we were in the lobby. They were doing our ticketing for us. They were ticketed performances.
Okay.
With cool. Like, yeah, that. So if you were coming to it, you would. Your experience before you walked into the theater would be very much like a traditional theater experience. We've also partnered with, so we partnered with the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society.
Ooh.
To do a series of shows in their pop-up gardens, and those were free.
Cool.
Yeah. So those were just like anybody who could get into the pop-up garden and was there at performance time was welcome to take a seat and watch the show.
What's a pop-up garden?
Oh, this is a.
I like the sound of it.
Yeah, so this is a thing that has really taken off in Philadelphia in the last, I don't know, like 6 years. I'm sure they are in other cities too. They're pop-up beer gardens in the summer.
Oh, cool.
So they take, abandoned lots that aren't being used, and PHS turns them into like beautiful gardens that also have food and a bar.
Oh, that sounds great.
Go away.
I was just picturing like, there's a pot of tulips here now, whereas before there was nothing.
It's for them. It's a little bit more elaborate, but they got so popular that other people started making their own that are not PHS affiliated, and some of those are more like, there's a pot of tulips. Here's our bar. The bar is the key part, I would say.
It kind of reminds me of the feeling of like yarn bombing. But like with beer and flowers instead of yarn. Is that the right idea?
It would be if Pennsylvania's liquor laws were a little less restrictive than they are. It actually requires quite a bit of permitting, I think, and wiggling around what are called the blue laws. And so I think PHS basically found this kind of loophole, and then other people were like, aha, a loophole.
Let's all jump through it.
Yeah,
that's very cool. So do you find then that Philadelphia is an environment like the city has a character to it that makes this kind of work there? Or do you think that this sort of Bearded Ladies mechanism would be able to transplant pretty seamlessly to any city in the United States?
I think Philadelphia has a unique vibe for a couple of reasons. One is that the last 20 years or so has been hugely influenced by the presence of the pig iron, devised theater. I don't know that they love the word devised, but that got their sort of ethos from Lecoq. And a couple of other experimental companies, Headlong Performance Institute, which is a dance company, and New Paradise Laboratories, which is Whit McLaughlin's experimental theater company. They all kind of settled into the city in the 90s and allowed this flourishing of a certain kind of performance that then attracted people who were interested in that kind of performance. And I think the city has hugely benefited from the kind of experimentation those kinds of spaces and gender. Around the same time, the Philadelphia Fringe Festival was also getting started.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding, and I could be wrong about this, so hopefully you have a fact checker on staff.
It's just but, me.
but I think, if I recall correctly, that even when they started, it was basically like, if you had a space and like a little, you wanted to like, give $20 or whatever to be in the festival, you were in the festival. And so that meant that there was no kind of jury or curation like there is in a lot of fringe festivals. Mm-hmm. And so people, I think, really took advantage of that to do some really wild stuff. Philadelphia has also been very affordable for artists.
Yeah.
Traditionally, which is a huge difference between Philadelphia and Seattle. And the city itself is not best at enforcing laws and permits.
Okay.
So it's not, I know they probably intend to be, but there's also just a lot of people putting on shows in their apartments, or using their empty lot next door without really going through. I mean, I think there's probably that there's less and less of that these days, but there was a time where a lot of those kinds of things were being overlooked by the city.
Okay. That's interesting. It is in DC, when I was in DC, that Philadelphia was the place that people would look to when they felt like they were being priced out. And maybe like Baltimore didn't feel like it was far enough away. So like, where could I start over and do my art? Philadelphia tended to be the siren song, especially for people who worked in museums as well, because last time I looked at these numbers, which has been admittedly a few years, Washington, D.C. had the highest number of museums per, you know, state or district. And then I can't remember if it was New York or Philadelphia next, but I think that Philadelphia has, I think it was like D.C. had like 104 museums and Philadelphia had 91. And so when you're looking at where can I go do this kind of like public history work, for example, or like work in a house museum or work with art, where does this scene exist? It was either super expensive, Washington, D.C. and New York, or get the same salary and go to Philadelphia and have a much lower rent. And so especially my museum professional friends, that was a very good spot to go be a young artistic person.
Yeah. Anyway. I think it also, that's really interesting. I didn't know that about the museums, but I'm not surprised. I think the other thing Philadelphia has going for it is, which Philadelphia wouldn't love, is it is close to New York. And so I think it does attract people who think that they're going to go to New York, and sort of let me make the big move to the East Coast and I'll start in Philly and then I'll like
Philly,
get settled and then I'll go to New York. I can get on the bus and go to New York auditions and live in Philadelphia. I know a bunch of people who that was their original plan and then they just got seduced by the wonderful artistic community in Philly.
Fascinating.
We still lose people to New York periodically, like I think every city does. But,
yeah.
But I think that allows... It allows people to feel comfortable making a life in Philadelphia because there's always that, like, it really is just a 2-hour bus ride. If you really want to go audition for Broadway, you can.
Yeah. Yeah. And you said you lived there for about 10 years, right? And and so you're not from there originally. What brought you to Philadelphia?
I went to college in Philly.
And then I liked it.
And then I loved the city and I stayed. I did leave for grad school for a couple of years, but I came back.
What made you decide on Philadelphia for college?
So I grew up in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how, like looking back, I'm like, how did I make this decision? I have no idea.
Just youthful.
Yeah, I knew I wanted to be in a college in a city. I went to visit. My family was huge on college visits, so I toured so many schools.
Oh, that's nice.
Well, yeah. I mean, it was like a lot of spring vacations went to that. And there was just I happened to so I went to the University of Pennsylvania, and I just happened to like the day that I went to look at it, the day that I was going to take the tour, it was like a beautiful fall day. The marching band was like happened to be out. So there's just like something that was like, you know. And there's it's a great school. So
yeah, but they don't have much of not to say they don't have much of a theater program, but they don't have a very deep theater program. Isn't that right? Because I toured there too.
yeah, that's true. And at the time, I thought I might want to be a dramaturg, which I know is unusual. But I also thought I might want to go into history, and I thought I might want to go into international relations. And so the theater program, I didn't look very closely at theater programs.
Interesting. So what did your major end up being?
Well, theater.
Yeah.
I majored in theater and, double majored in English.
Very cool.
And Penn's English program is great. What I like to say about the theater arts program at Penn, is that I think for a dramaturg, it was a really great education.
Mm.
There was a lot of theory and a lot of history. So when I got to grad school, a lot of my classmates who had come from more conservatory backgrounds were like struggling to like, to do all this like theory reading. And I was like, oh, I read that.
It's great.
That's fine. That's fine. I can just relax this week. Not entirely true, but yeah. But so I feel like I got a really strong dramatic literature, dramatic theory, and dramatic history.
That's good. That sounds delicious.
Yeah.
My cousin went to University of Pennsylvania, and he's a little bit older than me. So when I was 15, that was like my first campus tour. He was a history major. And I went and stayed at his, you know, college house with his like four dude roommates and it was like my first, you know, my first big girl trip across the country, and I just thought it was so enchanting. This was also the mid 90s, and he made me and my other cousin who came to visit made us a little map. It's called Map O' Shit. Oh, by the way, you're allowed to swear on this podcast.
Oh, great.
Did you feel the need? It's all going to get an explicit sticker and we'll deal with it later. But it was like, here's where you can go. And then it was just like, once you walk out the house, like, do not walk to the left unless you're going to go to the place on the corner where you can get a Philly cheesesteak. And beyond that, you're only walking towards the campus. It was definitely a... it was like a haunted kind of diciness, which I really liked, because it seemed like you were going to perhaps get attacked by the spirits of the people who lived in the mental institution down the street from the 1900s.
Uh-huh. Oh, I know exactly where you were. I lived across from that place.
Yeah, well, so did my cousin. I still find it very enchanting, and wish that I had looked at it more seriously. I didn't know what dramaturgy was, but I wish that I'd had the sense to look for something other than who has a good acting program. But my souvenir from the campus is still the big, what is it, Julie Baker Bronte sisters biography, which as a 15-year-old I'm like, oh shit, it's that Bronte sisters book I've heard about. I'm gonna get it. I'm gonna spend $30 in the university bookstore. So that's my tangent about your alma mater. But
alma mater,
warm places in my heart. Your school keeps coming up, I think, because Philadelphia is such a good theater town and such a good dramaturgy town.
It is.
It seems like we've got a lot of people in our community who are kind of in and out of that department, like teaching playwriting or, you know, just affiliated somehow. Anyway, I derailed that and I'm excited about it. So you had a really good interdisciplinary humanities approach to the work you were doing. So here's my biggest question. How, as a high schooler, did you know that you thought you wanted to be a dramaturg / how did you know that that was a word that existed?
Yeah, I get that question a lot sometimes. I was lucky enough to grow up in Baltimore. Baltimore has a, I think like a lot of places has a service requirement of like in its public schools of high school students. So I had to get a certain number of community service hours. And I did some of the traditional things like Habitat for Humanity and soup kitchens. And then I also learned that I could use my hours volunteering at Center Stage.
Oh.
And so I was a high school volunteer usher there. And as hopefully as folks know, Center Stage has a very robust dramaturgy department.
Yeah.
And so I was like seeing this word in programs and then was asking people about it. I was like, what is like, this thing?
What is this?
And then they were like, well, you kind of do theater and history and English. And I was like, those are all my favorite subjects. what an amazing career. And so that's sort of how that idea got planted within me.
Oh, I love that. I wasn't smart enough to think about that for my high school requirement. I think I do think that free babysitting counted, though, as long as the people I was babysitting for signed off on it. So I did that, and I did some, like, nursing home stuff because my grandma was in a nursing home. So it's like, all right, and I'll go talk to some other old ladies. I feel like I could have made better use of my...
Yeah, I don't know whether it was my parents or I did a bunch of weird, like I also volunteered at the Maryland Historical Society, which was great.
You're living my dream life.
Yeah. It was very crystallizing for what I wanted to do with my future. That's how I learned I did not want to work in museums. Although I enjoyed the volunteering, but
More about how you learned you did not want to work in museums.
I most of my time was spent shelving in the library. And so I think that sort of killed. It wasn't quite as exciting as being like in a dark theater right before the show starts. And yeah, I think it was more emotional. It was more of an emotional reaction than anything
else. Yeah, okay. I get that. My real digging into dramaturgy, I think probably was from doing museum work, or museum interpretation specifically, because it's all those like public history skills about helping people make meaning out of what they're encountering and figuring out what the right questions are to ask and how to connect people. And so a lot of those more abstract skills, like I think of it as being in a lot of ways museum work, but you know, dramaturgy as being museum interpretation for fictions instead of for either histories or visual arts or whatever.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And if I had since most of the work that I ended up doing was like me by myself in the corner of the museum, yeah. I think I maybe didn't make those same connections of storytelling and history and ambassadorship. It was more like sitting
just like with library dusty science things. Kind of.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I associated that with museum work.
Stupid museums. awesome. So you mentioned when we were emailing, the first episode that has gone out of this podcast was about burlesque, and you were talking about some of the differences between cabaret and burlesque. And in my mind, the main thing is y'all don't take your clothes off. Is what else does it boil down to?
Were that simple. I think the term cabaret has, it's a little hard because it's gotten appropriated by a lot of different forms. Burlesque is one of them. So like a lot of burlesques title their shows cabarets, which I have like no problem with.
It's not a call to arms.
Yeah, it just leads to a lot of confusion about what cabaret is. And one of the best, most beautiful things about cabaret is that it is a beautiful container for many different kinds of performance. So I think it can hold, like you can have a cabaret where you have opera and burlesque and like a stand-up comedy set and something else. So I wouldn't say that cabaret, I would say that cabaret can sometimes incorporate burlesque elements. I think the main difference is that for me, burlesque is a pretty contained form in that they all boil down to roughly, I mean, imaginatively and beautifully, and I love burlesque and I love burlesque artists, but the strip is the main, however you are interpreting the idea of the strip, like,
Or the tease,
yeah. It was described to me by a cabaret artist in Seattle named JoJo Stiletto as a
great name,
isn't it? Yeah, she's wonderful. Because I was working as a programmer for a year here at a venue that programmed a lot of burlesque, and I was like, I should learn more about this thing. And she was like, basically, it's the structure is you walk on stage, something magic happens, and you walk on stage with less clothing than when you came in. It's like, yeah, cabaret unfortunately doesn't for me have an easily identifiable structure like that. Mm-hmm. It's got some things that most cabarets have in common, which is that it does tend to have some kind of a variety form to it. So it is multidisciplinary. That could be the same, it could be one person doing multidisciplinary things for the full hour, or it could be many different acts that are strung together. I also think that cabaret has a strong presence from an MC.
Yes.
And burlesque often does, but
it's not necessary per se.
I think what I'm coming to realize about the kind of cabaret that I enjoy doing is that the MC really guides your experience in terms of a point of view. And so the MC of the cabaret pieces has something that they want to communicate, I think, in cabaret. And that can be personal, or it can be political, or it can be, but it's a little bit above and beyond hosting and just telling you who's coming up next, if that makes sense.
Oh, like, for sure.
That they're actually the glue that's holding the evening together.
And how do you rehearse an MC for a cabaret performance? And how do you script it? Or do question. You?
Yeah, my artistic director, his name is John Gerbo, and is the cabaret artist that I work with the most closely. We go back and forth on this a lot, because sometimes we will agree on what a script is, and then he gets in front of an audience and then says the things that we said we weren't going to say, or expands. Because so I think emceeing is a talent that some people have and some people don't.
So that sounds like there's a lot of improvisational comedy involved in it.
Yeah, it's hugely improvisational. It has to be, because it has to feel like it's a real conversation between you and the audience.
Right.
We talk sometimes, John will talk about creating a contract with the audience when when the show starts. And one of the contractual things is that we are all here together. And this, I think, Natalie also talked about in your first episode. Like, we're here together in this space.
Yeah.
In real time. We're not going to pretend that we are, that even if we've cloaked it in, like, this is the world that we're in, we're not going to pretend that you're not here.
Right. There's no fourth wall. It's just, or if there is, it's like the back wall of the actual physical building and we're all inside.
Right. Like, we're going to sit on your lap. We're going to talk to you. Like, those are important parts of cabaret, is creating a real and meaningful dialogue. And in order for it to be really meaningful dialogue, the audience has to trust you. And one of the easiest ways to break trust is to do something that feels false. And so what that means is that you need somebody who, if they're going to talk to the audience, they need to be able to actually have those honest exchanges. Which I'm sort of like losing track of what I was saying. But
that's okay. It's all good.
And so whoever is doing it needs to be somebody who can put an audience at ease in some ways, and can also think very quickly on their feet. Because the other one thing that makes the audience really uncomfortable is when they sense that the performance is off the rails.
Really? That makes total sense. But
yeah, even if the artist, there's an amazing cabaret artist in Philadelphia named Martha Graham Cracker, who is the creation of Judo van Reigersberg, who's one of the co-founders of Pig Iron, and Martha's particularly skilled at letting her audience talk to each other in a way that feels like it's going very far, but she is a master at getting people back as soon as she wants them.
Oh, that's important.
It's hugely important, because I have seen people who are new to the form, or perhaps less skilled in the form, just completely lose control of a room. It's when you have enthusiastic audience, as soon as they're like made aware that they can talk, you often have people who in the audience who like really have a lot that they want to share.
It's, and
they
the want to show, be part of this turns show. Out.
Yeah. And so that's a skill. It's also a skill to know who to pick and who not to pick to talk to, because like I would ironically hate audience engagement when it's me.
Yes, I do too. I want to be in charge of it, or I don't want to be there.
Yeah. I'm like the world's most reluctant audience member. So we do a lot of testing on me to be like, how does this make you feel?
How does Sally feel right now?
Would you do this or not do this?
Oh, that I value that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, and I mean, there's, so I do think it's a, I think a strong MC is, I think you can teach some of that, but I do think some of it is just inherent and has to do with how people focus and what their strengths are as performers. And some performers are really good at maintaining focus and character. And I would say MC performers are really good at improvisation and empathy and being very attuned to what is happening in the audience.
That's interesting and cool. And I think So I think that the last big topic I'd like to ask you about is about why audiences should go to cabaret, or why it's valuable to you. Like what can cabaret do for a person that seeing a play, or seeing even a burlesque show in some cases, or going to a museum can't do for them. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's true for the performers too. What does it do that other things can't?
Yeah. So the first thing I'll talk about the performers first, I think. I think a lot of people who end up in cabaret, like we ended up in cabaret very accidentally, and that's not mm-hmm. an uncommon story, which is that John Jarboe, our artistic director, was doing a lot of musical theater auditions because he thought he wanted to be a musical theater actor.
Oh.
And John is queer and uses he and she pronouns. And I think was feeling like the work that she was being asked to do never really reflected himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so somebody hired him to do a cabaret, and the form really spoke to her. And I think that's a really common story with cabaret, is that a lot of people turn to it because a lot of performers turn to it specifically because they're not seeing themselves reflected anywhere else.
Yeah.
And cabaret really values, I think the value that I find in cabaret, and I think the value that a lot of performers and audiences find in cabaret, is that it is a space that embraces you for who you are. I think that's also true of burlesque to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. And I find it to be true with stand-up to an extent too. It's people mm-hmm. who don't see themselves listed in the casting calls, but yeah. who still have like stage legs and things to say.
Yeah, we call cabaret the space for misfits, because, you know, theater is often described as like a place where misfits end up, and then this is the place where people who don't fit into the mainstream idea of like what theater is end up doing cabaret. Yeah, and a lot of times because they do have something to say or something to share, the kind of cabaret that I am most drawn to is the metaphor that we use is the poison cookie. Which comes from a quote by this German composer from Weimar, Germany, who wrote of cabaret that it was like, I'm going to like actually read the quote because I can't memorize it to save my life. He wrote, "Under the cover of an evening's relaxing entertainment, cabaret, like nothing else, suddenly dispenses a poison cookie. Suggestively administered and hastily swallowed, its effect reaches far beyond the harmless evening to make otherwise placid blood boil and inspire a sluggish brain to think."
Ooh, yum, yum.
Yeah, it's a beautiful quote. I wish I knew who translated it. I do not. But it encompasses, I think, what people are hungry for now, which is a way to talk about difficult issues or raise difficult questions together in community that doesn't feel didactic or painful, but... we sometimes talk about it as weaponized pleasure that we can. And so I think audiences are hungry for that. And I think they're also really hungry for community.
I like that.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's a little bit more immediate too. Like you're able to, if something is bothering you today,
yes,
it can show up on stage tonight. Yes. Instead of exactly. having to like go through a full like 2-year long play development process to talk about like, you know, the Supreme Court seat, for example.
Right. And it can be imperfect. And that's another valuable thing is that there's in cabaret, there's because we're all on the same level, the audience and the performer, failure is embraced in a way that I don't think if you're paying like $65 to go see a show at like Woolly Mammoth, you don't want to watch the actors trip over lines.
Yeah.
But cabaret really allows an informality that some of the best parts of cabaret are when something happens that the artist was not expecting and they have to deal with it.
Do you find because of the ticket price and the expectation differences, do you get a more diverse audience in say the lobby of the Wilma than you do in the main stage of the Wilma.
I don't know about the Wilma specifically, but I think there's a reason that cabaret and burlesque and some of these other forms are selling out, and larger and other more traditional theaters are having trouble getting audiences. And I think some of it is ticket price, but I also think some of it is what people want right now. And I think what they want are spaces where they can actually come together and be seen and heard together.
Yeah.
In a space that feels very live. We do tend to get a more diverse crowd, I think, than traditional models has been my observation. I think we can always do better finding audiences of color. But we also have a particularly, my cabaret company specifically has a particularly queer audience. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because of our identity in the city of Philadelphia as one of the more visible queer organizations. But also, I think some of it is that a lot of cabaret is in many ways a queer form.
Yeah.
And it attracts like-minded people, I think.
Yeah, it's funny. I didn't even think to ask you about the queerness identity marker, just because I think that I associated, Philadelphia cabaret is obviously going to be like gender nonconforming people, or, you know, people who don't identify as just like hetero, cis, whatever. It's funny. It almost, at least for in my mind, what is baked into the poisonous cookie already. That's just what's happening.
Yeah. And some of it, I think, is about is again this question of like who is performing, who is given the power in the room to perform in cabaret, which you have to, if you are a certain kind of artist, you have more of an impulse to make your own spaces. And then traditionally the form, it didn't start as a very queer form, but it became a queer form very quickly historically.
Mm. Oh, interesting.
So you have, when you think about Weimar Germany, for example, you have actually the scene was dominated by lesbians for a while in the Weimar era.
What era was that?
So Weimar Germany. So 19, so post-World War One.
Post-World War One. Okay.
Yeah. Up until the Nazis, really.
Until the Nazis said no more lesbians allowed.
Yeah.
Fucking Nazis, man.
Yeah, that's one of the things about cabaret history is it does always come back to Nazis. But even in America, it was, in the Harlem Renaissance, the cabaret spaces were much queerer than we think of them historically. Mm. And up through the 1970s, the New York bathhouse scene was very cabaret dominated. So that's where Bette Midler got her start, was in the New York cabaret bathhouse scene. And so these were often places where both queer artists and queer audiences could meet in spaces that felt normalizing. And that's something that I've come to value very highly about cabaret spaces contemporary as well. Like the early renaissance of the current incarnation of cabaret, I think, really started at Joe's Pub around 2000 with Justin Vivian Bond, Kiki and Herb, and Taylor Mack, both of whom, of course, are huge players in queer performance, contemporary queer performance. And so I think that the normalizing space breeds a loyalty and a community that I have not experienced elsewhere.
Mm. I think that's a great note to leave it on. We are unfortunately out of time, but I loved all of this. And for those listening along, we're going to have show notes. And Sally, if there's anything that you want people to know that was not a set of words that came out of your mouth already, let me know. We'll get it in the show notes. Cool. We'll point people to everything amazing about cabaret. Thank you so much for being on the show with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's always fun to talk to another dramaturg.
Yay! Sally Olive, everybody!
Thanks so much for joining us today on the Context Podcast. You can learn more about our guest and the topics we covered today by heading to thecontextpod.com. That's thecontextpod.com. contextpodcast.com. For exclusive bonus content, including monthly episodes and secret Spotify playlists and some other cool stuff, become a subscriber by going to patreon.com/thecontextpod. You can also follow along with our adventures on Twitter, where we are at ContextPod. And you can email us all your questions and episode ideas and thoughts and other things, just no dick pics, at thecontextpod@gmail.com. This episode of The Context was made possible by the 2018 Dramaturgy-Driven Grant from the Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas. Learn more about membership and how you could maybe get a grant for doing a thing you like at lmda.org/join. They don't require me to thank them, but it's a good group of folks, and I'm glad to be involved. They also don't require me to tell you that everything said on this podcast is my own opinion and not necessarily the views of LMDA, but that's also true. I don't think that LMDA would put dick pics in their closing bumper as a phrase to say. Anyway, that's all on me, not on them. Thanks for joining us.